Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Data, analytics, big data science, machine learning, customer insight, behavioral science, blockchain, data ops, data engineering, agile working. Phew, too many terms, too many things to think about. Do you as a leader need somewhere to turn? To hear what other leaders are doing? To hear what really makes a difference in your business? Welcome. The Customer Insight Leader Podcast is here for you. Each episode, we'll be interviewing a different leader in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics to hear what they really do, what really makes a difference. So settle down, get that cup of coffee, and enjoy the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast, a place to hear from today's leaders in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics. I'm your host, Paul Loughlin, and with me today is Avis Estelle. Avis is currently head of consumer at Lux Asia. That's an omni partner of fragrance, skincare, makeup, hair care, and luxury lifestyle brands across the Asia Pacific region. Whew. She has a passion for differentiation through service, customer experience, and automated personalization. To achieve that, she draws on her background, both client and agency side, working with major retailers, banks, airlines, telco, and broadcasters all over the world. She explains her work as connecting people, data, marketing, and customer experience to translate business to IT and vice versa in order to digitally transform companies. Quite a CV and quite relevant today. Welcome, Avis.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Very, very pleased to have you with us. I first met Avis, listeners, decades ago. Sorry to make you feel old, Avis. It's much more me. While she was heading up the insurance practice for Experian. So it's good to talk again after all these years. Thank you also.
Different world, actually, all those years, I have to say.
Yes, indeed. Thank you also for expanding our international reach by joining us from Singapore today, expanding the reach of this podcast to now also include data leaders from Asia. So let's get started. We've got plenty to talk about. Could you, in time-honored fashion for this podcast, start us off by giving us your backstory, a bit of background on the many different leadership roles you've had during your career to date?
Sure. So I'm not someone who has a career plan. I'm not someone who says in 5 years I'm going to do this. I'm someone who is quite happy taking opportunities as they come and understanding what things, you know, cause change. And I'm quite comfortable with that. So when I look at where I am now, I don't think I could have ever have worked out I was going to end up here when I started my career. So, you know, I started in help desks, and that's a good training for everyone to do with customer experience. Absolutely. Went into business analysis, business consultancy. And that's where I met you, Paul, when I was working for the insurance business. Mm. And from there, I went and ran development teams and more help desk teams because you always have customer service. And eventually moved into business management, so leading businesses. So I've run the insurance business, which was a mature business that needed some cost cutting. Mm. I've run a background checking business. And that was a business that had been acquired, and it was in, you know, some disarray, I think is the best way of describing it. And we had to work out, did we sell it? Did we keep it? How did we make it profitable? And of course, we did make it profitable. And then I came into a digital business, which was Cheetamel. And Cheetamel was an email marketing business. And this really set me off onto a totally different way of thinking. And I remember when I joined Cheetamel, I'd said to the guy who recruited me, you know, I know nothing about email marketing. And he said, I've got 100 people who know email marketing. I haven't got anyone who knows anything about running businesses. Mm. So I learned fast the digital side. And that's become a real passion for me because the speed is there and the testing is there. So from digital, I went wider. I went into a Hitwise business, which was Insights. And then I went backwards for a while, came to Singapore, loved Singapore, but went back into credit and delivering systems for banks and financial institutions. Mm-hmm. That really wasn't for me. It was slow. It was hard. It was deathly difficult. And trying to get everything working together, just very, very hard. And it really just didn't make me smile each day.
Yeah.
So from there, I came and went into a luxury concierge company as a contractor for a while, decided I was staying in Singapore, but not with Experian. And I'd worked there quite a long while. And then finally, I found my place in LuxAsia. And this was another big step for me because I'd never worked client side before. I'd always been agency. And moving client side is totally different. You learn so much. I've learned so much about beauty and about retail and about e-commerce. And it's very different this side. So, you know, I would never have thought from where I started to where I've ended up, I would end up in Singapore with 15 countries, 100 plus brands, and, you know, doing all the marketing, the insights, the CX. You know, I'm kind of an accidental CX and marketing person.
It's a lovely way of putting it. I love that phrase, an accidental marketing and CX person. There's a book title in there somewhere, Avis.
I'll write it down.
Yes, absolutely. Well worth mentioning. You mentioned at the beginning not kind of having a career plan. That's kind of how things panned out. What kind of thing influenced the choices that you did make along the way, though? Because clearly, unlike some guests I've had on this podcast who stay maybe even at one company, you've done quite a lot of taking on different roles and challenges and sometimes moving companies as well, and doing that internationally. I wonder what helped guide you on those steps along the way, even if they felt a bit more like they arrived than you planned them?
So they weren't all knowingly done. Some of them just because of circumstances. So, you know, when I was in the insurance business, the answer to that business was to roll it into our credit business. So I kind of made myself redundant. So you know, you find that you very quickly need a job when you make your previous job redundant. And I did the same with background checking. You know, it also needed to be put into a different bit of Experian. So some of them was getting to the right answer for the business and then going, oh, that wasn't the plan. And other ones were really because of organizational change. And organizational change is difficult. So, you know, I've gone from different roles because there was an opportunity, because we've either joined things together or put things apart. But coming internationally for me was I would say it was my husband's whim. So there was a time in the UK, and there was about 6 summers where we didn't have a summer. Do you remember that time where the summer was in on a Wednesday and we were all at work? And then you came home at the weekend and it was cold and it was raining and it was horrible. And my husband just hates that. I mean, he loves being warm. He loves blue skies. And he said, oh, just get on the international list. I'm done. And he'd also done with his business. He was running his own business and he needed a break.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, yeah, sure. This is going to happen. And wasn't expecting it to.
Yeah.
And then 8 weeks later, we moved to Singapore. And that was much faster. And, you know, I didn't imagine for a second that would happen. But it did happen, and it happened really fast. So, you know, I think the moral of the story is if you tell people you're mobile, you better be, because people do pick you up and they do then move you to other parts of organizations. It has given me a bit of a wanderlust, I have to say, coming to Singapore. I've lived here. We're in our, seventh year now. You know, it's a fab place to live, and we travel so much outside of COVID.
Yeah.
So making that move where we'd seen most of Europe, we'd done a lot of the States, and then coming across to Asia and not having to do that long haul thing. It's now short haul to get to business and to get to leisure travel, which will happen again, I'm sure. You know, that's really an interesting thing to do. And you know, I'm really, really pleased I've managed to work with all these different countries and different cultures. It's a beautiful thing learning to work in different cultures.
Tell me more about that. I'm interested because it's become almost a bit of a sub-theme through a number of guests on this podcast. Maybe it's just the kind of leadership careers we focus on, but I'm thinking back to Kanika Giganti from Vitality, Alison Williams from Dunnhumby. There have been a few guests who've really cited how they've grown and developed as leaders through working in different countries. What's the beautiful thing? Do you mean the opening up of your I guess, growth as a human being, your openness to other cultures? Is it something more about how you develop as a leader as well?
Yeah, I think it is. You have to find different ways of communicating.
Okay.
So, you know, very often I'm speaking to people who speak good English, mm-hmm. and because my other language skills are sadly lacking. Mm-hmm. But you have to be careful how you talk. You know, you can't use English slang. Yeah. I can't be talking in my best East End, talking to my friend's voice. You know, they won't understand a word of it. So you have to think about how to make complex things simple. Mm. And you have to think about, will they ask me the question? You know, because in some cultures they won't. They'll just go, yes, can. But that doesn't necessarily mean they've understood. Yes. Or they've understood something, but not what you meant. Mm. So it's the challenge of being able to communicate with people who don't know what you're talking about frequently, because I teach digital for a living, don't speak English as their first language, mm-hmm. and who don't have any context to my background or my slang. Yes. So I have to talk slow. I have to consider. I have to explain more, and I have to ask more. So, you know, say that back to me. What does that mean in your world?
Yeah.
So there's that whole piece of self-awareness that I find, you know, very, very, I don't know, exciting. How do I make sure that I'm doing a good job? Because it's my job to change, not their job to adapt. And then, of course, you have got all the fantastic cultural things. So, you know, I know more about Chinese New Year than I ever thought I would. I never in my whole life thought I would have to design a red packet, which is where you give money at Chinese New Year. You know, I didn't consider that I would ever celebrate Diwali so much and all the Muslim festivals and, you know, being part of teams with different ways of thinking with different food, because food is a great enabler and, way of joining together. All those things really, really work for me. And I really enjoy it. And I really miss traveling and seeing our teams. I've got this sort of visceral need to connect with people, and it's fine over Zoom, but it's not the same.
No, I can completely agree, and I'm sure there'll be many listeners jealous of the fact that such international travel has taken you to Singapore, so regularly cited as one of the best places in the world to live. So nice achievement, Avis. As you've touched on communication, I'm reminded when we spoke before, you talked about how when you were in the analyst roles that you highlighted earlier in your career, you kind of learned the questioning skills to dig beneath what people were asking for to what they really needed. I'm interested how much that's, because you've taken on quite a wide variety of roles and often been in roles that were new to you, not just international cultural, but the kind of functional focus as well. How have you learned to use questioning to dig beneath what others say they need to get to what they really need from you?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It is helped by the fact that, you know, if you look at my Myers-Briggs, I'm an extroverted thinker. So I think by asking questions. I have got a really strong reflective thing, which means I also have moments of going, now, does that make sense? Like, do I understand it? So I've got an ability to internalize things and line it up and make sure that I can join it all together. And then that questioning ability. And I guess because I ask questions all the time, it becomes easier for me to ask difficult questions. So I often say to people, you know, don't worry that I'm asking loads of questions. It's not that you're explaining it, it's how I learn. Yes. But that also enables me to do the thing where I can say to people, do you know that or do you think that? Because knowing something based on empirical evidence is different from believing something based on something internally or something someone said something. So I think it really helps that I can balance those two ways. You know, I take information in, but I can also ask those, you know, more sort of probing questions back to people, and then can use the data that we have, of course, to say, well, do we think that or do we know that? Because if we know that, great, but the data says, and then we're into a different conversation. You know, the data says our customers are not 25 to 35. Actually, our highest spenders are 35 to 45, and they repeat more often. So I think that whole questioning attitude really helps, but mainly it helps me understand other people's worlds. So how does that help you achieve this? What's the information you need? How does this work? Because I think sometimes we're all very, you know, capable of learning the high level, but you need to dig a bit deeper to understand how things really work. And then that gives you all sorts of different strategies and different ways of doing things. And that, I think, is quite an interesting thing to do. It's like doing a puzzle. You know, you can get all the pieces and then you have to get them all in the right order, but you don't know you've got all the pieces until you get nearly to the end.
Yeah. And nicely put, Avis. I'm struck how much that's kind of an articulation of Stephen Covey's old seek first to understand and then to be understood. And it kind of sounds, again, I'm hearing that consideration of the audience. So much of communication is about empathy for the other and your reassurance to people that you're questioning for your sake. It's not because they don't get it or they're failing to understand. It's, I guess, in questioning and listening, you need to flex your style to make sure it works for the other person.
And that's the basis of all marketing, of course, because I'm not marketing to me or someone who knows the brand or our brand managers.
Yeah.
I'm marketing to consumers. And then you have to think about, well, what is going to be interesting to them, not what is interesting to me, because they're frequently different things. And that's a lesson we learn a lot when I'm teaching brand managers how to do this. I'm like, yeah, you are the best in beauty. You understand these products, you understand everything about this brand and these products, but the people we're talking to don't. So don't assume a level of knowledge, but make sure that you've found a way of giving that knowledge in a way that's accessible and, not patronizing in any way.
Yeah, absolutely. Good marketing wisdom. I was also struck by your use, and it is such a powerful, simple question of do we know that or do we think that? And that pause of checking. It reminded me, I've had a bit of a theme on the blog lately of data literacy education and educating senior leaders to be more data literate. Is that, I'm sure that's a common challenge for you as well. Is that one of the techniques you use to do that, is just get them to stop and think what they actually know and have evidence for? Or are there other things that have helped you make your peers and senior leaders more data literate?
Yeah, so I think first of all, you have to understand, you help them understand why data matters. And remember, most leaders are very data driven, albeit it might be in pounds and pennies. I had to think what pennies were for a moment there. I think I've been in Singapore too long. I was going to say cents, and I'm like, no, it's definitely not pounds and cents. Everybody is quite analytical if they're at a business level. They're looking at their sales, they're looking at their profits. And data is just another way of looking at something. So, the first thing I always do is talk to people about why do we want to have this data and what will it give them? So give them the big picture. And then we can start drilling down and gradually teaching them. But I think the best way of teaching anyone is when we're trying to do something specific, and then we ask ourselves a question and then get the data to get to the answer. So, one of my colleagues today said to me, for this brand, why hasn't this happened because of COVID? Can we look at the data? Now, that's when you know you've won, because somebody asks themselves a question and then goes, the answer's in the data. And I think that's really fabulous, where people can then join together their thinking to say, okay, we have an opportunity or a problem, but we don't just have to guess it with attitude. We can go and understand more of this. We may not understand all of it, because the data doesn't always give you all the answers. Of course it doesn't. Life's not that simple. That would be amazing. But it gives you enough to ask the next question and the question after that. And it also gives you enough to say, it's not that. And I think that's really important, that once you get people thinking like that, it becomes really easy for them to ask questions back. And when they ask questions back and you can give them the answers in the data and it makes their strategy different, then you've won. Because then we're making great decisions based on facts. So we know that, or we know nearly that. Yeah, we don't necessarily know all of that. And I think that's really important for everyone to understand what you can use, but also where's the noise. So sometimes in data, you can get lost in it. You know, I can look at data for days, but it's not always cost effective. So, you know, you have to start with something real to solve. And I think that's what's really great, is that we've moved, as we've taught people through real life problems, we've moved to the point where they habitually come and ask the question, how do we do this? You know, is it here? Is it in this report? Is it in this report? Is it in this dashboard? Or is it something we need to look at? And then you think, yeah, that's great.
Yes, absolutely. You've trained in that Pavlovian response almost to a problem. it's good. I love it. By the way, I love the phrase guessing with attitude. It sums it up.
That's what we all do.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess another dimension of the challenges you faced is, as you mentioned, you're now in a client side role after so many years of being a vendor side or agency side. How much of a difficult transition was that to now be inside a business and not selling things in or consulting, which is a different perspective?
It is, because the devil is in the detail. And so when I used to be vendor side, I used to say, oh, you know, this is X times click and you'll get Y times that, and you know, and
yeah,
all very vague. And then you come client side, and you know, Luxasia is a very complex organization. We've got 15 countries and we've got over 100 brands. So, you know, 15 times over 100 really, you know, blows your mind.
Yeah.
And the thing was, there's no playbook for this. So, you know, there's no playbook for how do you industrialize marketing and customer experience in a beauty company with multi-categories, multi-countries, multi-levels of maturity. Yeah, you know, there's not something you can Google. And so I think the first thing was, wow, how complex is this? Like one of my colleagues said to me, when you started, if you knew it was this difficult, would you have started? I thought that was a great question. And I think the answer was just about yes, but there was moments where I had my head in my hands going, I just don't know how to do this. And then you're like, but nobody knows how to do this. So I'm going to have to work it out. So, you know, you get so much information when you first start. And I think it took me 2 years to have a good understanding of the business. I knew enough to get started, but now I think I understand the ecosystem well enough and the brands well enough that I can join it together in a different way. And it's like, oh, if only I knew then what I knew now, I wouldn't have done that and I would have done this. But, you know, that's A-B testing for you, isn't it? We got there because we tested, and then we're like, that doesn't work, that does work. So, you know, a great example is fragrance. Fragrance is bought by most people as a category, which means you'll have 5 to 8 fragrances, and they probably won't be from the same brand. You might have 1 or 2 from the same brand. But we used to market by brand. So, you know, the vast amount of the people out there weren't getting the marketing to the way they bought. Now, the data told us that, but then we had to work out, well, how do you do multi-brand fragrance marketing if you're not a store like Sephora? So there was lots of tests we had to do, and that became really interesting. And we're still working on that now. You know, we have a Fragrance Future Forces a group of people, and we're looking at where do we go next in that category, because it works differently from other categories, works very differently from skincare, for example. So you know, you never stop learning, and I am still amazed how brilliant retail is as an industry. You know, from the people who stand on the floor to the people who work out e-com stores to the finance people, just, you know, to the warehouse, the things our warehouse have to do, packing gift with purchase, you know, special packagings, making sure everything arrives on time, servicing big customers and e-com customers. Yeah, wow, it's a very complex thing, and you have to think about all of that, because if you drop any of that, if one part isn't aligned, you get a terrible customer experience. So, you know, I think that's that's a really interesting place to work.
Yeah. No, I hear that. And although challenging, I'm sure kind of intellectually very satisfying as well, the complexity of things to think through. Stepping back though, hearing that, the relishing almost of the challenge within retail and the amount of marketing elements, thinking back to your whole career story, I guess I'm struck how brave you've been in your career, Avis, at certain points. Others might have discounted themselves from moving across barriers you've moved across. You know, you've moved into marketing roles, you've moved into completely different sectors, other countries, roles that you might not have seemed entirely suited for at the time. I wonder whether that's worked out well for you. I wonder whether you'd encourage other data leaders to be braver in their career choices and consider more options they could explore.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. So some of the moves, it's easy to be brave when there's a difference between having a job and not having a job. So if you've made your job redundant, moving to another part of the organisation in a different segment actually feels quite comforting, because you know how the whole organisation works. There's just a small bit you have to learn, which is this new business. Yeah. So sometimes I think it looks braver than it is. Mm. And sometimes I think I've stayed in things too long and I've been maybe too loyal. I stayed with Experian for years and years, and I had a brilliant career and really enjoyed all the different roles, maybe not the credit one where I came to Singapore. Well, definitely not the credit one. So you know, I think it takes on sort of this heroic thing when people look at it from the outside. Okay. But actually, it's just a pragmatic thing. I need a job. I need something that's going to interest me. What is out there? And then you go and talk to people and you know, get options of things you can do. And some of them you look at and you go, duh, that looks the same. And maybe sometimes the same doesn't look so good. You know, that just feels like Groundhog Day. Mm. And then you can convince yourself when you move from, you know, background checking to digital marketing, that enough of it's the same. You know, I'm still running a P&L. Mm. I'm still running people. I'm still understanding the challenges of being out there. I'm still selling.
Yeah.
I'm just selling different things. So I'm at the stage now where I think I can go into any industry and I probably can learn it. You know, I couldn't be a brain surgeon or an accountant. That's just not for me.
Yeah.
But anything within this skill set that I have with the core competencies you're going to use, yeah, I think I could do that. And I don't think that's brave. I just think that means I've ticked off enough of it to feel confident and I'm curious enough on the rest of it. And, you know, curiosity is a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's an interesting observation that it's that kind of combination of a range of core competencies that are applicable quite broadly and that curiosity. Yeah, it's interesting you bring it out. I think you are definitely onto something. I guess the other way of looking at this, and I was kind of struck this as I thought about our conversation today, that in some ways you're quite an unusual data leader. A lot of the people that I've interviewed on this podcast are still definitely in roles that maybe sometimes explicitly have the word data inside their job title, but they're certainly understood as data and analytics or data science roles. I guess a number of the leadership roles you've had, I describe as sales, operations, or marketing leadership roles. But knowing you as I do, I know you've got this great foundation in understanding data and how to use data through analytics and technology to achieve what's needed. Do you still see, after all these years, that grounding in data is what enables you to succeed in such business leadership roles?
Oh, absolutely. So to me, data's everywhere. If you're not looking at the data, how can you possibly be a marketeer? You know, marketing is not a thing where you kind of just, you know, it's not about talking about colours. It's not about branding necessarily. There's a whole world of data in that marketing discipline.
Yeah.
And I think people don't necessarily think about how much data there is. They think of maybe, you know, a 30 years ago marketing role and try and compare it to today. And, you know, marketing people now are data people. They absolutely, because everything is based on how did that last campaign work. So, you know, I'm always looking at return on ad spend, the open rates, the you know, the attribution of revenue, you know, all that good stuff that helps you work out, did that last thing you do work or not? And if it didn't do, why not? What was it about that particularly that caused an issue? So I think data's coming out of its closet, so to speak. It's coming into roles now, and it's part of everything. You can't run a call center without data. You can't run people in store without data. How do you pay commissions? How do you understand where your rankings are? How do you understand what stores are doing well and what are not doing well? So data is everywhere now. So I don't think the data bit has to sit to one side. Now, there's plenty of people who are much better at data than me. So I'm a user of data. And what I can do is I can take data structures and say, what I need to work out is, How often do people buy? How does their basket size increase? You know, are they new customers? Are they existing customers? What gender are they? Are they tourists or are they locals? And all those questions, which come from thinking about how I'm going to market, get an answer from the data. So to me, data is always part of something. Sometimes I even forget to talk about data because it's just something we use. It's like saying, I have a pencil or I have a laptop. Well, of course you do. When I have data and I make decisions based on data and I use my business analysis background and my IT background to join it all together to get the right answers. And to me, that really makes life much easier and much more interesting than being stuck in a silo. Having said that, I am in awe at data scientists and people who can churn data and give trends and, you know, really do that next level down. I have an analytics manager who works for me. She's brilliant. My daughter's training to become a data scientist and she's going to be a rock star. So I'm in awe of those people. It's not a skill set I have, but I know how to use that to get the right business results. And I think that's the side of data I sit in. I'm an avid data user. And I have to create data if it doesn't exist.
Yeah. Okay. No, nicely put. I'm tempted to try and lure you into some controversy here. Oh, go on. I will. I'll pick up on the phrase you said that it almost doesn't need to sit to the side. I guess I'm kind of reminded of the argument that was going around a few years ago of, we only needed chief digital officers initially. They should sort of do themselves out of a role because digital needs to be part of everyone's role. And when we've matured enough, there won't be a separate digital function. It will just be part of all the other functions. Are you arguing the same for data, that we don't need a separate CDO or data function, but when we mature fully, data will be part of all the functional roles and will be a core competence already embedded?
I hope so, because then data's one. Then the facts are in charge, aren't they? So I do think there'll always be a need for specialist skills, because if I look at data, you know, it's not something that everybody can do as part of their job. Mm-hmm. So I kind of look at this model that says, you know, in LuxAsia, we build dashboards for the whole organization and we build them once for use by everyone. So if I've built something, I want everybody to use it. So, you know, you should all know, once I've built it, your time between purchase, your average basket size, your top customers, all that good stuff. It comes to all of you. Now, I wouldn't expect, in fact, it would be really silly for all of our teams in our 15 countries and our 100 plus brands to go about building that. That's just not effective. Yeah. But I think the use of data should be everywhere. So I do think there's a case for the specialist team with that great competency to be able to build the models and build the insights working with the business. But I think once it's built, it has to run throughout the business, and then everybody has to know how to use it to get the best out of it for what they're trying to achieve. And so that's a bit of a hybrid model, but you have to get it to everyone. You know, you can't have just a data group of people who understand everything and then a group of execution people who understand nothing. Yeah. We need to be able to get them talking to each other. And that's when you need to be able to interpret from like brand people to data people to tech people, you know, because it's only when you get everyone speaking the same language, and even if they all speak English natively, you still don't speak the same language. You're all talking totally different things, different ways of saying it, and, you know, different ways of explaining it, and all the jargon that everybody uses that stops people engaging with them.
Yeah.
Ban jargon, use data.
Yes, ban jargon, use data. Nice, nice. You're full of the catchphrases. You must be a journalist's dream. Like this. I completely agree with that higher level of data literacy across the organization, embedding that, and then in some ways, I guess, focusing even more in your data function on specialism and expertise, that becomes more and more excellent. Whereas the level of competency in doing the basics is there across the organization.
Yeah.
I guess I'm also don't want to pass by the fact that clearly the trajectory of your career, if I could look over it with hindsight, is more and more towards digital marketing. We'll focus on, I guess, digital transformation would be the popular buzzword these days. Mm. But I find that, as well as always the danger of a trendy term, is that that's often portrayed more as a technology project. And I don't always hear enough emphasis on the key role of data and analytics in digital transformation. I wonder, do you see in successful ones, data and analytics leaders having a seat at the table for the key decisions? Do you think we've cracked making that happen and not just implementing technology to be digitally transformed but dumb?
So I don't think lots of companies have cracked that, if I'm really honest. Mm. So to crack it, you need to work somewhere like Luxasia, which is flat in structure, that has a, you know, transformational brief. Because, you know, 5 years ago when Luxasia started its transformation, there was no offline, there was no digital, there's no online, it was all offline. So I think you need to say it, you have to create the environment for transformation to happen. And it doesn't matter whether you call it digital or data or, you know, offline or online, that environment, that cultural change needs to happen. And there needs to be lots of education about why and how and what this means. And that actually, the cultural change is much harder than the tech change or the digital change. So you can put as much in as you want that's digital. We've done tons. But if nobody understands why and everybody hates it, then it's never really going to catch on. So what you need to be able to do is to give people things that they find useful and not give them too much too soon. Mm-hmm. So with our data particularly, we've built our dashboards up over time. So we started with some really simple stuff. We started working with retail operations about collecting consumer data. Yep. And we gave them all the metrics. These are the people, these are the stores, these are the brands, these are the people that you got data with transactions. This is data without brands. Yeah, we just went very simple. And then over time, they'd come back to us and say, can you do me a report on date of birth? Because date of birth is important because we want to send birthday presents. And we're like, yes, marketing's about happy birthday. Good job. Yeah. And we added it. And then they're like, well, could you also give us, you know, this information? Could you break it down in a different way so that we can really see who's delivering and who's not? So we built that need for data. And then once we got that right, which gave us the base data to be able to do more interesting things, we then started building the brand reporting. And we started very simply. These are how many people you've got on your mailing list. These are how many people have bought. Oh, look, this is how often they come back. And then we built it down and built it down to the point where people come to us now and they go, can you split that by new and existing? Can you tell me of the top 100 customers, how many of them have bought this particular product? Can you tell me how many people who bought the old version of the product and it's been relaunched haven't bought again? How many people who came from this store that's closed have now turned up at a new store? And so you gradually reel them in. Yeah. And that becomes really an interesting thing to do, because we have reports now that I couldn't really dream of when we started, and they're being used every day. In fact, you know, if our systems go down, people now message me and like, well, why isn't Tableau working? You know, I need it. I've got stuff to do. And I'm like, that's fabulous. They're annoyed that it's not working. So data becomes everywhere. And I think it's really important that it doesn't feel like a big transformation when you start. What it feels like is something useful. And then you add something else, and then something again, and then you drill it down. And before you know it, you've got digital transformation and you've got data transformation, and no one's really noticed. But if you did it all in one big go, everyone would be scared to death and they'd be running away.
Yeah, no, nicely explained, Avis. And I think you're so wise that so many digital projects fall, and it's the same for data and analytics, can fall into the trap of they so want that first deliverable to impress, they put too much functionality, too much complexity into it. Mm-hmm. And I agree completely. If you start simply and you let the psychology of desire build, that you almost limit or put economics lens on it, you limit supply in order to develop demand. That's the right psychology and culture to begin to embed.
And it also means it doesn't cost you as much, because if you want to do this big bang super duper thing, you need a big team to do it fast. Mm. Where if there's just two of you, you know, there's only so much you can do at once. So you are naturally throttled by your own capacity. Yes. So we kind of got there by luck rather than judgment, but it's a good insight and I'm keeping it.
Okay, good. You own that. Okay, before we finish, I always try and protect some time on each podcast interview to give something back to those who are listening to this podcast who are a bit earlier in their careers. So mixed audience listen to this podcast, people who are younger and earlier in their careers, and people who are older, maybe in similar established leadership roles. So looking back or thinking about the people who you work with who are earlier in their careers, what tips would you have for those who are developing their data or analytics career and they want to think about what skills or knowledge they should be developing? Where would you guide them to develop?
So I think the first thing you have to do is you have to have a boss who invests in you. Mm. I think you have to have someone who gives you things to try and lets you work alongside others so you can see how people with more experience can do it. Mm. And I think you need to volunteer for things, even if they're a bit scary. So, yeah, the first time I sold something, I think this was probably when I met you. No, it might have been afterwards. It was when I was in the insurance business. And I sold a database of motor insurance policies. And I'd never sold a database before. And I'd certainly never contracted that before. Mm-hmm. And I'd definitely never built one before. Mm-hmm. But I kind of looked around and went, well, no one else is going to do it. So I'll have a go. And, you know, what was the worst that can happen? If no one else was going to do it, we wouldn't have got it. So I do think there's a bit about being brave, a bit about taking things that are not the day job, and a bit about, you know, giving that curiosity room to run. And so that does mean taking things on in addition to what you do now. And some people look at that as a great burden, whereas I've always looked at that as a great blessing. Because you're learning something new. If, you know, if it all doesn't work, well, it was the first time you ever did it. There's no consequences normally. But usually you come out of it much stronger. So I'd say find people who will give you opportunities and guidance and just suck it all up and see if you like it. Yes. Because it's only through making these changes that I've learned that I can sell, that I can talk, that I can present, that I can join up all these things. And that, you know, the thing I can do is look at a whole load of things and go, oh, right, that's how it all fits together. Yes. If you only ever look at one part of it, you're never going to work out that you have a skill to join up multiple silos. Mm-hmm. So try things, stand next to people, ask people to explain it. Mm-hmm. And you know what? You'll learn things. Sometimes you might learn that you hate that. That's great, because that means you haven't got to go there again later in life when you thought you did. Although some of us are silly enough to have done that and gone back to credit.
I was going to mention credit, but there we go.
Well, there's not to say you get it all right all the time. Of course you don't. There are times when you get it incredibly wrong and guilty as charged. But do have that curiosity to try other things, because you might just love them.
Beautifully put, Avis. And I love the themes of bravery and curiosity coming through. It's good advice. And it's advice I don't think that another guest has given on this podcast. So thank you for that. Okay. Time is against us, unfortunately, although it's been great to chat. Final question I've given all guests on this podcast. Can you give me an example of something you've changed your mind on in the last few years, just so we get that insight to the way you're still changing and developing and growing?
So I think this links to, you know, my credit story and how I didn't go back there. So it's not changing my mind on credit. I think what I've changed my mind on is what speed an organization can work at. So okay. I always thought I could work in an organization of any speed. You know, for a while there, I thought I could work for government. And luckily, someone who I was on an Experian course with looked me in the eye and said, "Oh, Avis, stop yourself. You will just kill people because it will be so slow. You won't be able to stand it." So I think I've changed my mind on what types of organization and what types of culture I can work in. And I know that I need change. I know probably it's a transformation. And in most of my career, even though I wouldn't be that grand to say I've had transformational roles, they were.
Yeah.
And I think I need places that have got agility and excitement. And the excitement may be deadly boring to others, of course, because what I find exciting, other people find very weird. But I think I've changed my mind. I can't work for slow moving organizations. I can only work for organizations that want to run, that want to try and want to change. And that's been a huge revelation to me, because I thought I could do that and I really can't. And it's okay not to be able to do that.
Absolutely. I think it's important wisdom for us all to learn in our careers. I think that growing self-awareness of where you'll be fulfilled, happy and productive, and where it won't work can help people avoid all sorts of misery. So no, thank you for sharing that, Avis. And many thanks for your time today and everything you shared with us, Avis. It's been a pleasure to chat with you.
It's been a pleasure to chat with you too.
Thank you, Avis. And thank you, everybody, for listening. I hope you found that helpful and continue to listen to the Customer Insight Leader podcast. More great interviews coming up. And each week, there's also fresh content on our blog, customerinsightleader.com. So you might want to check that out too. Before then, thanks everyone for your time. Have a great week. And perhaps watch out for those opportunities where you can be a bit braver, try something. And above all, as Avis keeps saying, be curious. Have a great week, everybody. Bye.